You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good. Let's get started. I'm Martin Bailey at Brookings, the director of the business initiative here, and also working with Josh Lerner on the Private Capital Project, which is joint with Brookings and the Private Capital Research Institute. And we're delighted to have this event. This is the third such event that we've had. And I think all of them have been a success. I think this one will be too. We've got a terrific set of people talking and presenting. We've got a great audience, and please get ready to ask questions and push people forward and so on. Since there's no test at the end of each presentation, if you want to move up to the front and fill up the front, that's always good, but you know it's hard to get people to do that. Okay, let me just say a bit of context about what we're going to talk about today. The title is Promoting Innovative Growth, and we're looking at venture capital, growth equity, and IPOs. I'm going through my notes, and it now says, tell them logistics about lunch, so I better break off and just tell you the logistics about lunch. There will be box lunches that will be available, and they come... So there's panel two is sources of capital for funds. That's the one run by Josh Lerner. And at the end of that, there'll be box lunches out there. If you don't like the box lunch, Brookings Cafeteria has stunning gourmet food, and you can go and get that some of that from yourself, or you could rush out to DuPont Circle and get something better. But hopefully, the idea of the box lunch is so we can bring everybody back in time. So we only have set aside about a half an hour for lunch because we want to get everybody back, and we do have the presentation by Ajay Agarwal, and then we're going to have the keynote from Congressman Jim Himes. So I think the after-lunch session is not to be missed. Okay, now get back to what I was going to say a minute ago. So I think the context of this meeting today is that, as we know, growth has been very sluggish. Quite a bit of that is sort of cyclical, tied to the financial crisis. We really have the missing piece, I think, of this recovery, which is business investment and business hiring. Some folks say it's the housing market, and of course the housing market was crucial to the decline that we went into. But at this point, housing investment, residential investment is actually climbing pretty well. It's a strong point in growth. It is true that the loss of housing wealth has depressed consumer spending, but even there, in the last few quarters, consumer spending, while it's been relatively slow, has kept pace with the growth in consumer income. So households are not, in fact, saving a lot and attempting to pay off more of their debt. They are basically spending whatever income they have. So in order to get this, get us back to a stronger, more vigorous economy, there's an issue around state and local spending maybe, but for our purposes, I think the issue is business hiring and business investment, and that's what's needed to get this ball rolling a little faster. The large businesses, large and mature businesses, generally don't have problems with cash. They seem to have a lot of cash on hand, as we read all the time. Some of it, obviously, not located here in the United States. But if they want to invest, they have the opportunity to invest. They have the cash. They can do it. So that piece, yes, investment and hiring are somewhat weak there. Obviously, what's restraining them is not a lack of financing for the most part in the large and mature businesses. On the other hand, if you look at younger, smaller businesses, I think there's a pretty good case that lack of funding is one of the factors that's restraining investment and hiring in that sector. Clearly, if the rest of the economy were booming and everybody were looking at missing out on opportunities, there'd probably be more hiring, more investment. So general uncertainty is a factor. But it looks like funding is also a factor. Banks have become more cautious. Small entrepreneurs who typically had used the real estate value in their homes to borrow, and that has gone down or is not available in the same way. So access to the venture capital market has been pretty depressed, and so there's not a lot of money out there on venture capital. There are different views about this. What is, you know, is it really funding or is it really something else? That's part of what we're going to explore today. But I think this is a very important issue to explore the nature of funding for those businesses that are potentially going to grow, going to hire, going to invest, and be a key part of the recovery. Just one more piece of it from my point of view. I've spent a good part of my own career studying productivity. And I'm one of those folks who believes that if companies are able to produce the same output with fewer resources of capital or labor or energy, then that's a good thing. So the rise in productivity is helpful in the long run to economic growth and even to living standards. But we have had maybe a little too much of that since 2000. Looking certainly at the aggregate data, so this is not something that's true of every company, every entity that you look at. But if you look at the overall data for non-farm business, the productivity growth we have had, in some years it's been quite high, has really been restructuring efficiency-driven productivity rather than numerator-driven productivity, the output of the output growing that pulls along investment, that pulls along hiring. So that's again, another piece of what we're looking for to get this recovery going is innovation-driven growth, and new ideas, new products, new services, things that help attract new customers and expand employment and investment. So this is the focus of today, we're going to start. We have very good. You have the outline, I think, so I don't need to go through everybody. The bios are also available there, but it's a pretty. I'm pretty excited about this crew that we've come here. Thanks largely to the efforts of Josh, who's been instrumental in bringing in such a group, a good crowd. So, to start us off, I'm delighted to say we have our first speaker is David Robinson. I was intrigued reading his bio to notice that he has written on blackjack tables in Vegas. So I was slightly tempted to ask him questions about that, but I think we better do that offline because it's maybe not, I guess maybe that's one way of getting small business finance. I don't know, but not the usual way. So he's an authority on venture capital and funding for young and growing companies. And he's going to talk about alternative choices of financing for young companies. So, David, thank you and welcome.
So thank you very much, Martin, for having me. Let me see. Just what I was waiting for. I won't be talking about the appropriate strategy for how to play blackjack. Instead, what I'm going to do is talk about the financing choices of young firms. I've titled the talk this way just so really that it conforms to what you see in your bulletin, but really the message that I have for you today is much more narrow, much more focused, and it's on the role of debt and lending, bank lending, in the startup process. Note that I said the word startup as opposed to small business. We've understood for years and years that banks are important for the small business economy. But what I want to talk to you today about is the fact that banks are important, bank lending is important for the startup economy. I should say at the outset that please, if I'm going through the slides and you'd like to raise a question, please do so. And if I don't see your hand, just blurt out the question. I'm used to that. So let me start just to kind of frame the discussion a bit. Let me start by describing what I think of as sort of a myth from the MBA classroom. And I use the word myth somewhat provocatively. I've certainly perpetrated this myth, but I want to talk about it for a minute. So the myth starts with the idea that startups are opaque. And because they're opaque and because they're startups, they're necessarily screened out of debt markets. because bank lending is not available to startups, they then are forced to turn to a variety of other sources of capital. They go to the venture market if they can, or they rely on some combination of credit cards, friends and family, informal lending channels, informal capital channels. And as a result, that kind of all just feeds back on the opacity of the startups in the first place. Now, the problem with this as a myth is that a lot of what's on this slide is actually correct. In other words, venture capital, while most startups don't get venture capital, the ones that do are incredibly important for the economy in terms of job growth. So venture capital is an incredibly important part of the equation. For the firms that rely on them, friends and family type funding, credit card, you know, access to sort of personal finance is really important. The real problem with this, the real facts break down and where this becomes a myth is really in this top arrow here. In other words, the fallacy is that because startups are opaque, they're screened out of debt markets. And so what I want to do is try to think in terms of what is a more accurate picture and think about startup capital coming from basically, you know, venture formal equity sources, informal capital sources, and formal bank lending channels. And the question really is, what's the relative thickness of these lines? And you can frame that in a number of different ways. You can frame it in terms of innovation, in terms of job creation, in terms of business starts. What I want to do is just show you some evidence from the Kauffman Firm Survey about the role of formal bank lending just in the business start process. So just as an overview, what I want to do is I'm going to quickly show you some evidence on the role of debt in the startup process. And as I've said before, this is distinct from the role of banks in the small business sector. What you're going to see from this is that housing is an incredibly important source of collateral for many business starters. And as a result, that's going to have some policy implications that I'm going to try to talk a little bit about. I'm really not going to make policy statements as much as I am going to raise some policy challenges that I see based on the data. Before I get into it, as a way of getting into it, I don't know if Josh and Martin did this on purpose, but the organization of today's discussions kind of proceeds along chronologically through the life of the firm in some ways, because I'm going to start at the very, very earliest stages of a firm's life, and then you're going to hear later in the day, you know, our next panel is going to be on growth capital, and then we're going to hear about IPA. So we're going to kind of be watching firms mature as the day wears on, and we're going to start with the very process of the startup act itself. So the Kauffman Firm Survey is something that I've been involved with doing research using the Kauffman Firm Survey for a number of years. Let me tell you a little bit about what the survey is, and then I can show you what it tells us about the role of debt in startup capital structures. So basically what it is, it's about 5,000 firms that were started in 2004. Starting in 2004 means that in 2004 and not in 2003, they either began paying unemployment taxes or FICA, they established a legal business, got a tax ID number, or someone filled out a Schedule C on a personal tax return. These data were assembled through a Dun & Bradstreet sample frame that they use for doing credit score modeling. This gives us an incredibly heterogeneous pool of startups, both in terms of owner characteristics and in terms of business characteristics at founding. And then what the Kauffman Firm Survey does is it goes in and in a pretty high level of detail, asks a lot of questions about the nature of the business relationships they have, the financial structure that they have, and some of the founder background information. So in terms of founder demographics in the Kauffman Firm survey, what you see is that founders are overwhelmingly white males who do not self-identify as Hispanic. Their median age in the survey is sort of 35 to 44 in that age bucket, although about a third of them are over the age of 45. The median person in the survey has upwards of 10 years of industry experience. So this is not college kids staying up all night in a dorm room coming up with the next app that's going to change the world. This is a middle-aged man leaving a career, leaving a company, continuing to work in the industry in which he has developed a lot of industry expertise, but starting a new idea, something that he's identified, a gap somewhere that's not being filled. If you look at the characteristic in the Kauffman Firm survey, more than 40% of them have had at least one prior startup before the startup that the Kauffman Firm survey catches them on. And if you look at the operating statistics of the companies themselves, the Kauffman Firm survey catches a huge range of companies. About one third of them are pre-revenue in the survey year. But around a sixth of them have revenues in their first year that exceed $100,000. So there's a fair degree of heterogeneity in who these companies are. And remember, we're looking at them in their first year of starting. So I guess a picture is worth 1,000 words. So this is a 3,000-word slide. First, I want you to focus on the bar on the left. That's taking all the firms in the survey and basically just looking at what their capital structure looks like. And I'm going to characterize their capital structure in perhaps an unusual way, but a way that's going to be very useful going forward. I'm going to think about characterizing the source of capital in terms of who is providing the capital. So in particular, the orange, which is going to be the main focus of my talk today, is at about 40% of the total capital of the firm when it starts, is outside debt. And that means debt that's being provided by banks. And you can look at the colors and see where the other sources of capital are. The next biggest is owner equity. And the survey works. You can never know how well this is being executed, but the survey is doing its best to get respondents to distinguish to not include home equity draws that they're injecting in the form of cash. That is not supposed to be in this bucket. That's supposed to be in the orange bucket. So you can, roughly speaking, think about this as the blue is personal savings and the orange is bank debt. And the other colors, which don't add up to very much on average, are debt that they're obtaining from other people and friends and family that they're providing themselves, or equity that they're getting from outside. Now, one of the things we had that was really neat about the Kauffman Firm survey is we had the credit scores of the firms involved. So one of the first cuts you can do is just cut on whether this is a high credit score firm or a low credit score firm. And bear in mind that these are firms that are in their very first year of founding, so a lot of what you think about their credit score is really something that the firm is inheriting from its founders. And what you can see is that there's, to my estimation, very little difference in the proportion of total capital that's coming from bank debt, depending on whether you're high credit or low credit. So maybe what we're looking at is just barbershops. And maybe that's not something we really care that much about. Maybe this is not the kind of part of the economy that we think is interesting. So let's look at high-tech firms. Let's flesh out all the firms in the survey that do not self-report as operating in a high-tech sector. Roughly the same picture. outside question. They oversampled high-tech firms so that they had good representation of them, and then they used sampling weights so that you got back to sort of roughly the same proportions as you see in other surveys. And I'm using weighted data here. The capital structure story looks very similar when we look at high-tech firms as when we look at non-high-tech firms. High-tech firms have about 30% bank debt on average. You break it across high credit, low credit. What do you see? Well, high-tech firms, credit is telling you something about firm quality. And the high-quality firms are actually relying more on outside equity. This is for 2004.
Meaning it doesn't have the crisis. It's for companies that started 2004, only for that a year.
This is a snapshot of a point in time. That point in time is pre-crisis, 2004. I don't have pictures for that, but I can tell. In a minute, I'll tell you a little bit about the progression of capital structure over time. I don't have much after the crisis in today's talk. But what you can see is pre-crisis, basically debt and equity kind of move in lockstep together. They continue to go back to bank debt as the firm grows. What kind of debt is this? The blue is personal loans that have been obtained for business purposes. The red are business loans. Part of the challenge here is that it's very difficult to decouple the corporate balance sheet from the personal balance sheet when you're looking at a firm in the very year it's being founded, right? And so there's a conflation of the two balance sheets, and you're seeing that here because what's happening, a lot of what you're seeing in terms of personal loans for businesses will be loans obtained for business purposes that are secured by personal assets, home equity, savings, et cetera. Together, those make up 70% of the total debt. Add to that a business credit line, and you're up over three-quarters of the total debt of a firm is coming basically from lending facilities provided by banks. So what's the difference across these different firms? The capital structures look similar. What's the difference? The difference is size. To your question, high credit firms are just a lot bigger than low credit firms. And your average high tech company is just a lot bigger than the average firm that's starting. Let's look at more cuts of the data. Let's go at the end we probably don't care about that much today and look at garage businesses. So the reason why you might want to look at what I call garage business, we're talking about people who have not yet moved out of their home. The place of work is the home. We're talking about, so on the far left we have firms that only have the founder as an employee, no other employees. In the next bar what we have are businesses that do not have a place of business outside the home. The reason why these might be interesting is you might think that these are people who find it very hard to go to the bank and get debt. But that's not what the picture shows. It shows roughly the same proportions as what I showed you before. I can look at pre-revenue. I can look at post-revenue, but pre-profit. These are survivors through 2006, and these are ones that closed before 2006. And there's only modest variation in the average amount of debt these firms have. There's massive variation in their size. I can also look at equity-backed businesses. So these are companies that obtained some form of equity backing, venture capital, angel finance, equity backing from other companies. And what you see is, obviously, not surprisingly, if I'm conditioning on the presence of equity, equity is going to make up a large fraction of the total capital in the firm. And you can see that the equity is the green. But what's the second most important source of capital in an equity-backed company in the year it starts? Debt, the orange. So the same kind of the same kind of bank. So I want to talk a little bit more about this because one of the weaknesses in the survey is it's hard to identify the exact source that in which a particular loan is being collateralized. And so we're kind of trying to triangulate on some of these issues, and I want to show you some work that other people have done in this vein that point to the importance of housing as a source of debt. Now, I'm not going to stand on a limb and say that this, you know, that the average VC-backed company here involved using home equity to secure the debt. The data just don't allow me to draw that conclusion. It's very likely true on average, but I can't speak specifically to that with the data that we have. It's just a limitation of the data. That's exactly what I want to talk about at the end in terms of policy. I think the facts that we're seeing here raise some policy challenges for how we want to think about moving forward. And I look forward to hearing your thoughts about that. I think this is important. Sir?
She's at post-crisis.
Yeah, absolutely.
How relevant is this debt?
Well, everything I'm going to tell you now is pre-crisis. All the stuff I'm going to show you is pre-crisis. This is a picture of what the world looked like before the financial crisis. And so the question then is, given that we're in this post-crisis world, what kind of policy challenges do we face based on how we know the world to have looked before the crisis? The difference is, again, size. So to summarize, basically, startups access bank debt at the very earliest stages in their life. This is an incredibly robust fact. It's robust across firm types. It's robust over time. And to your question earlier, debt continues to be the primary source of funding on average throughout the first 4 years of the firm's life. So as a firm is growing, it's going back and it's plowing back any profits it makes into the company, but it's also trying to tap additional debt. It's sort of all sources of capital sort of growing roughly proportionally. So that's kind of speaking to this complementarity of debt and equity. It's not that as the firm gets bigger, the equity is taking the debt out of the company. You're just seeing kind of debt and equity together grow proportionally. And that complementarity suggests that financing constraints are important. As firms grow, they grow using every source of capital they can find. Now, I think of these, sort of the stylized fact here as far as I'm concerned is that variation in firm characteristics, what I've shown you, has a first order effect on the size of the startup, but only a second order effect on the mix of debt and equity that the startup uses. And what I want to show you next is some evidence that variation in the availability of debt is partly responsible for what we're seeing here. And all I've shown you thus far is that startups and debt mix. That might be because debt is really attractive for startups. What I want to show you is that it's the availability of debt that is driving part of this. Now, even on a huge screen, I realize those are small numbers. So let me just summarize what the numbers say. What the numbers say is that access to outside debt is greater when homes are more pledgeable as collateral. And so the way we're doing this is we're using some measures that were created by Saez at Wharton looking at home supply elasticity. And in areas where the supply of the elasticity of home supply is larger, those are areas where home values won't fluctuate as much in response to a demand shock. So that means that the home equity is more pledgeable as collateral. You can also look at states that have state bankruptcy exemptions, and you'll see that where the home is exempted out, you see lower access to outside debt. So areas where there's geographic variation in the degree to which a home provides a source of pledgeable collateral, you see with that variation in the reliance on outside debt. This is just what we were able to show in the Kaufman Firm survey. My colleague Manuel Adelino and Antoinette Shore and Felipe Severino have a working paper. I think they're actually going to be talking about it at the NBER this Friday. They're using publicly available data, and what they show, again, this is all pre-crisis, but what they show is that if you look between 2002 and 2007, areas that had strong exogenous home price growth saw stronger unemployment growth, and the unemployment growth was focused in, employment growth, yes, jobs. The employment growth was strongest at the small end of the firm size distribution. So so their data allow them to classify firms according to the number of employees, 1 to 4, 5 to 10, and so on. Areas that saw home price growth, it's not the case that you see a huge amount of growth in large establishments. You see a large amount of employment growth in small establishments. So, for example, the effect that they're picking up is about 3 times larger in firms that have 1 to 4 employees as do firms that have more than 20. It's also the effects that they're picking up are most salient in industries where the capital requirements are lower. So it's about 3 times larger in low capital intensive industries than high capital intensive industries. In other words, the story that's coming out of this is that if you're in a high capital intensive sector and you're operating a large firm, well, then fluctuations in the value of your home aren't going to do much to change the amount of capital that you access. But if you're in a sector that has low capital requirements and you're a small firm, well, fluctuations in home equity can have a big impact in your ability to access outside capital. And that's showing up here in their numbers. Well, they're using different data than I am. So they're not relying on the Kaufman Firm survey. They're using data from the U.S. Census to do this, the county business patterns data. So you'll have to look at their paper to get all of the details out about that. But basically, they're lumping together lots of different types of firms together here. And most of the cuts are just basically on capital intensiveness. So this is what's this is where we have a challenge empirically, and this is related to your question earlier. The real smoking gun is that if you can find data that look at what an entrepreneur did in terms of refinancing their house to take equity out to put in the business, these data don't allow you to do that because they're looking sort of very macro at county level employment patterns across the firm size distribution. My data don't allow us to do that either because although we have very fine data on the source of capital, and so I can tell you whether it was a personal loan or a business loan or a line of credit, I can't tell you enough about how that was collateralized. So these are some open questions the empirical challenges that we face trying to get a better understanding of this. Yes?
Shouldn't the causality be reversed? Places that have strong employment growth will have, because people can afford houses, will have strong home prices.
You're absolutely right, and that's why they went to such pains to generate exogenous home price variation. So they're making use of the same variable that I'm using here in this supply elasticity variable. And what Saez did is he looked at he used like GIS software, spatial analysis tools, and he tried to identify places that, because of the configuration of rivers and streets and zoning regulations, there were exogenous barriers to home development, right? So the point you're raising is an absolutely critical one, and it's related to what Martin was saying in his introductory remarks. We know that home price growth fueled consumption. But what this is showing you is that home price growth also fueled collateral.
Are these sources prioritized? In other words, I'm a small businessman. Do I have a preference as to whether I go to a bank or I go to my house or I go to friends or family or not?
It's really hard to say because we're looking simply at equilibrium outcomes. We're looking at we're not able to ask the question, did you get the bank lending because you first went to friends and family and they turned you down and therefore you found yourself here? We're seeing just a snapshot at the end of the year of what actually happened. Now, some evidence to your question, though, it can be gleaned from the fact that over time, firms continue to go back to banks to borrow money as they're growing. And so if you thought that bank debt was a really undesirable source of capital, then you might expect to see as the companies grow, they begin to substitute out of debt and into other sources of capital. That is not what you see in the first few years of a firm's life. Yeah.
If you're a small businessman and you want to borrow and you've got equity in your home, then the bank wants a hold on it. I mean, there's no.
That's right.
They're not happy to have you. They want your money in that.
That's certainly my anecdotal understanding of the way this market operates. You talk to founding teams, and they'll tell you stories about bringing in an extra member of the team because they had a very strong personal balance sheet. Right, because they needed to be able to bring collateral to the table in order to secure funding. I've heard that anecdotally. Absolutely. So why is this fact important about the home equity collateral channel affecting the small end of the firm size distribution more than the others? Well, if you look at data on small business employment, It's the small business employment phenomenon is really a young business employment phenomenon. It's young businesses that are starting small and then growing that are responsible for the job creation that is such a policy priority. So there's the line between entrepreneurship and job creation runs first through small young businesses and then through home equity as collateral. And so in terms of policy challenges, I think to me this kind of identifies three policy challenges that I think we should spend a lot of time thinking about. I know Ronnie's had some, who you're going to hear from later, has had some similar thoughts. First, I think we need to be very careful to decouple policy towards business starts from policy towards small business. What the Haltewanger paper shows us is that there is no systematic relationship between firm size and employment. Small businesses don't create jobs. Young businesses create jobs. Young businesses are small because they face the capital constraints that I've just identified for you. The second challenge, I think, is that we need to embrace the fact that innovative growth almost surely means accessing debt. And so if we want to promote innovative growth, we need to think creatively about the ways in which business starters can access debt markets. And there's a lot we could do in that regard. We have to think very carefully about that because there's a lot of ways you can mess that up. And then the final, I think, policy challenge, and this is related to some of the comments that I was hearing from the back about the crisis. We need to look squarely into the mirror and acknowledge that the housing crisis is an entrepreneurship crisis. And that you can't, you know, if you're going to have policy that's oriented at fixing the housing market, that needs to be paired with policy that's promoting entrepreneurship. So I'm nearing the end of my time. I want to make sure that I give room for questions. I'll just put up this slide in conclusion. Most small business growth is young business growth. Startups access bank debt even at the very earliest stages of their life. Variation in firm characteristics has a first-order effect on firm size, but only a second-order effect on their desire to go out and access bank debt. That bank debt is being collateralized to a very large extent by home equity, and that means that we need to think creatively about debt access to small firms. So let me take some questions. Yes, sir.
Can you Yes, my name is Bert Gorovsky. Way back in banking, 40, 30 years ago, different world. A banker was always told, don't give a loan to a young firm or anyone based on collateral. The collateral is an additional thing, but you have to believe in
that. The idea, right.
That's the basic idea. Now, when we see this in the new modern banking, the regulators have decided that whatever is risky, these small young firms, the bank is required to have much more capital than whatever is not risky, officially not risky, if there is such a concept. In that respect, many of these mortgages are placed on loans by banks in order to dress up the operation as not risky, because that allows them to hold much less capital. So how to be able to separate all this tangle is very hard, because the real basic fact at this moment, in terms of policy and creative solutions, mm-hmm. what we are doing, we are telling banks, look, you're not allowed to earn as high risk-adjusted returns on equity when you lend to young startups that when you lend to the sovereign or to whatever is officially AAA rated. And the differences are just huge and tremendously, especially in times when bank capital is scarce. So it's very hard, you know, from all these data separate out all the different factors. But bank regulations have definitely. And 2004 on, with bank capital becoming even more scarcer,
yeah,
these discriminations are made even much worse.
Yeah, I completely agree.
Yes, a question concerning retirement income. To what degree did you see, either statistically or anecdotally, the impact that retirement income has if the average person is middle-aged? I could sort of relate to that. And if a lot of your equity is in your home and the housing crisis hits and all of a sudden value's down, your retirement fund is down, now the next thing you're thinking about is the golden years of your life. How does that play into this?
It's hard to see how it plays. I think that it plays into the story in an important way. It's very hard to tell the story with the data that we have, because we're not able to isolate, for example, someone drawing out of their retirement to provide capital for the startup. We're not able to separate that from pulling money out of a savings account. It's just simply whether you're providing personal equity in the business. So this is, again, there are a lot of the questions that we're hearing today, I think, are interesting because they point to empirical challenges that we face when we're trying to understand kind of how to, you know, sort of how capital markets connect to entrepreneurship activity. And there's no question that personal finance is sort of, you know, one of the main vehicles through which the banking sector connects to entrepreneurship. Understanding how that breaks out across home equity, retirement, et cetera, I think is a really important question for future work. 5 minutes, okay. Yes.
Could I ask for a bit of clarification about the high-tech sector? Because I think you said that in your sample, they had the larger capital, therefore they weren't necessarily the sort of dorm garage startups.
That's right.
And I'm wondering if there's a hypothesis that actually high-tech sector has two opposite segments, one which creates jobs and one where really the technology is being used to destroy jobs.
That could well be true. Well, I think that the type of high-tech companies that we're looking at tend to be job creators, because they tend to be the type of companies that combine high-tech capital with high-tech labor to produce some kind of intellectual property or product that's used by someone else. I happen to accidentally have learned of a company in the Research Triangle area that's in the Kaufman Firm survey. Well, I was having dinner with a local entrepreneur, and he said, "Oh yeah, I'm in that Kaufman Firm survey you speak of," And that would very much describe his company, where they take a lot of high-tech capital and combine it with a lot of PhDs and try to produce an innovative new way of doing something. Let me take, yes.
Most large money center banks and most Main Street banks don't understand high-tech startup businesses. I mean, they just don't understand them. And, you know, I'm from the Boston area, and you know, there are boutique banks that focus on high-tech lending, like mm-hmm. Silicon Valley Bank, to name one.
That's right.
There's almost a symbiotic relationship between them and the VCs. They lend to companies that the VCs have sort of endorsed, if you will. And they also look at it a high-risk sort of loan, they get warrants and so forth. I mean, from a policy perspective, I mean, apart from sort of having a healthy housing market, you know, what are ways in which we can produce more Silicon Valley banks or have traditional banks sort of get smart and start get educated in this sector?
One thing that I think is a challenge here is that if you think about the way most bank securities work, once the loan, they don't really experience the upside of success. They get the loan repaid, and that's the end of the story. That affects their incentives, and that makes it hard for them to do the kind of lending to high-tech companies where all the payoff is on the upside. And that's exactly why you see them piggybacking on the due diligence that VCs do, the banks that specialize in high-tech lending. So I think one thing, one potentially fruitful innovation here would be innovation in security design, innovation in contracts that would allow lenders to take a piece of the upside. So very simply put, you can think about warrants being coupled with loans in a way that would give the lender some of the upside and thereby affect incentives. There are a number of policy ways in which you could implement something like that. I think exploring the details of that is interesting and important. I think I have time for maybe one final question, or maybe we're at the end.
you mentioned variation in firm characteristics has a first-order effect on startup size, and I'm sort of interested in the characteristics, but maybe going a little bit broader, there's a huge diversity. I mean, you've got restaurants, you've got high-tech companies, you've got dry cleaners, all these sort of startup and small companies are very different from each other. So if you do some cuts by industry or by type of company, are these results you're finding pretty much go across the board, or are there a lot of variations as a result?
No, the capital structure results are robust to looking across different industry sectors,
which is pretty,
what I suspect is the case is that if you are able to dig deeper into the debt itself, you'll see that there's interesting variation in the way the debt is structured based on the industry setting or the institutional setting in which the company is operating. But if you're just looking at the level of debt, equity, personal equity put into the business, you see very little variation across the types of dimensions you've just described. Okay, let me yield the stage to the next panel. Thank you very much.
Terrific.
Okay, good morning, everyone. Welcome to Brookings and our first panel discussion on growth capital.
My name is Ronnie Chatterjee. I'm a professor at the Fuqua School of Business at Duke University. I'm joined by four outstanding panelists today. Over the next 50 minutes, we're going to have an interactive discussion about growth capital and its importance for the U.S. economy. We want to hear from the panelists and also leave enough time for questions and answers, so let me be very brief by way of introduction. I think one of the reasons this panel is going to be very informative is because we rarely hear about these kinds of investments. We hear a lot about venture capital in Silicon Valley, where people take risks on ideas coming out of a garage or a dorm room. We hear a lot about the other end, big-time private equity and the leveraged buyout firms, especially during the presidential campaign. But in between, there's a large number of investments made that we call growth capital. These are mid-sized businesses with proven business models, financial track record. They're seeking capital to make an expansion, get into a new business, geographically expand their operations. These are the kinds of investments we're going to hear about today. For those who aren't familiar with these investments, they can often come at a very important inflection point in the life of an enterprise. So we can think about this being a time where numerous jobs can be created and value can be unlocked. One of the unique things about America is actually the number of mid-sized businesses we have. So this growth story is incredibly important. So today we're going to try and understand a little bit more about how and why these mid-sized businesses grow, and also a little bit more about how public policy can impact that. So I'm going to go one by one and let the panelists speak, and I'll introduce them before they speak. So to start, let's go to Bron Jones. So to give us an introduction to growth capital, growth capital 101, as we call it. Bron is managing director at Outcome Capital in the investment banking practice. He does advisory services for M&A, debt and equity private placements, and he also specializes mostly in technology and service companies, both in the commercial and the government market.
Bron? Thank you. Thank you very much. You know, I thought the first presentation was very interesting, and it shed some light on some of these sources of capital, such as your home, credit cards, and so forth, that can come from the people who actually start the businesses. But kind of advancing the stage a little bit, I thought what I could do is just kind of, you know, you have seed capital, private equity, subordinated debt, preferred equity. There's all these things out there, and I thought I could just take a moment to try and define sort of each category and throw some numbers out there so that you can get a better sense for how these different sources of capital line up next to each other. We heard a lot about debt with the first speaker. You have senior debt and subordinated debt. Generally, from a cost perspective, from a cost of capital perspective, senior debt's going to be the cheapest source of capital for the entrepreneur. So they're going to get as much of that as they can before they move on to these other sources. And then you have equity. And I'm not going to hit on the areas that Dr. Robinson did, such as taking out your home equity lines and credit cards and so forth, but he was calling he used the term outside debt and outside equity. So that's what I'm going to be focused on here, is when a company actually gets to the stage where it can stand on its own, what kind of financing is available? Well, they can go out and they may have assets, they may have some cash flow, and they can get some senior debt, but there's going to be a limit to their capacity to do that. They're only going to have so much assets or so much cash flow to pay the interest on that debt. They can then go to the subordinated debt markets and perhaps get some more. But at some point, if they're a very promising business and they're recognized by venture capitalists and private equity investors, they are going to get equity capital to help maximize the value of that business. And I said I was going to try and define these different buckets of external equity capital a little bit, and I'll put them into three buckets: seed capital, venture capital, and private equity. And we have a private equity story here today. Seed capital is generally from friends and family, as Dr. Robinson pointed out. It can come from angel investors, but it's typically individuals. Can be as little as $25,000 or $50,000, maybe up to $1 or $2 million, and that kind of gets the company going. The next stage would be venture capital. Venture capital and private equity capital are run by professional investors, and they have pension funds, endowments, institutional investors, and individuals that give them their money to create a fund, and then those professional investors hopefully make good decisions, invest in companies, and realize a return for their investors. So venture capital really gets started in amounts of about $500,000 to maybe $10 million or more in capital. Private equity really gets started probably around $5 or $10 million in capital and can go up to well over $100 million. So that's really the core middle market. When you hear, that's another thing I can kind of define is what is the middle market? I've seen it put many different ways, but the lower middle market is generally $10 to $100 million in revenue. The core middle market, by my definition at least, is about $100 to $500 million in revenues. And then above that, you have the upper middle market, which is $500 million to $1 billion. And it's really this, as Dr. Robinson pointed out, these smaller companies, under $100 million, from $100 million to $500 million, that are really the lifeblood of the U.S. economy. That's where all the jobs are being created. So these sources of capital, both venture capital and private equity, are very important to that market. In fact, I can share with you some statistics in just a moment. But before I do, I wanted to explain one more thing in terms of the cost of capital. You know, from an investment banker standpoint or a CFO's perspective, you have to come up with that capital structure for your business and hopefully optimize that so that you're not paying too much for that capital to reinvest into your business. And then you use the business to provide a return on that invested capital. So it's that spread that the entrepreneur is trying to maximize. So senior debt's the least risky. It's backed by assets. Subordinated debt is next on the layer. Those are both on the liability side of the balance sheet. And then you get to the equity part of the balance sheet where you have preferred equity and common equity. The risk is lowest at the top and becomes more risky as you get to the bottom. So the cost of the capital correlates with that. The cheapest is at the top and the most expensive is at the bottom. So that's how capital structuring is done. You go through an analysis of that and try and determine what you can get at what cost and maximize the value of the business. There's a website out there called growtheconomy.org that what they've done is they've taken a Dun & Bradstreet affiliated database called NETS, which has $44 million businesses in there. And then they've taken another database from PitchBook, which has about 16,500 companies that were backed by growth capital, either venture capital or private equity. And they've mashed them together to see what kind of data they could get. And this is right in the center of that lower and core middle market that I was referring to earlier. And some of the statistics here, now these are private capital-backed companies being compared to the general U.S. market. Private capital-backed companies grew 81.5%, while all other companies in the U.S. economy grew jobs by 11%. So a pretty stark contrast there. So companies like Brad's are really the stars of the middle market, these private capital-backed companies. Also, with regard to revenue growth or sales growth, private capital-backed companies grew 132.8%, according to the website, while overall United States sales grew by 28%. So a pretty big difference there. So, again, just making the point that the middle market companies are vital to the U.S. economy and the capital that backs those companies are equally critical.
Great. So so those statistics are very interesting, and kind of a face on those statistics is Brad Antley, who is the CEO of Salient Federal Solutions, also the chair of the Northern Virginia Technology Council. He formed Salient in 2009 and is here to tell us a little bit about how this worked for his company.
Okay. I'm up next. So I'll start back with SI International, which was the first company I was involved with, supported by private equity. It was formed back in 1998, which was sort of the height of the dot-com era, and at a time when it was very difficult to find growth capital for something that didn't have dot-com at the end of its name. So, it was rather unsexy at the time, brick-and-mortar kind of services business supporting the federal government. So in the financial markets, thought of as low margins. Today, obviously not so. But back then, it was certainly an uninteresting business. Knocked on a whole lot of doors to try to find interest in supporting the business plan. And after many months of doing that, was fortunate enough to find Frontenac in Chicago that had a program called CEO First. And I'll let Walter tell you a little bit more about that. But saw the advantage in diversifying their portfolio of investing in a government services business, although at the time I think we were their first play in the sector. So it was a bit of a leap of faith for them, but I think they had confidence in the plan and the management team and invested a little over $30 million with the team. In 2 years, we acquired about $105 million worth of revenue with that $30 million investment. Levered ourselves about five times in terms of debt capital. And that's when everything fell out of the dot-com market, out of the telecom market, out of the commercial market, and the debt markets went way down. So we were stuck. We eventually had to go public in order to access additional capital. It was not available to us in the debt markets at the time. And so that, then we went public, and we wound up selling that business 10 years from the start later at $600 million of revenue, 5,000 employees, to speak to the notion of job growth. So that was a reasonably good success. So sailing on to Salient yeah. briefly. We obviously had some experience at that time. The business rules have changed. The market had changed drastically. We no longer could execute the kind of model we did for SI International because the federal government changed some rules which inhibited that. So instead of being able to go out with $30 million of equity, we needed a lot more in order to execute a business model today. And so we went out looking for $100 million worth of private equity and imagined that we had lots of interest at that point. From private equity companies in backing the management team and our business plan. We were fortunate and Frontenac was able to pull together a facility, a group of LPs, and through their fund to back the business again. Picking a private equity player is a dicey for an entrepreneur because it's an important relationship that's going to drive how that business operates going forward, and not all private equity players are the same. So it's a really important relationship from an entrepreneur's perspective. So we're now 2 years into, or a little more than 2 years into, our company, Salient, and we're running about $250 million in revenue, a little over 1,000 employees, and on a path, we think, to grow that significantly over the next 5 years or so.
Great. And as you say, Brad, choosing the investor is a very important decision. And so Walter Florence from Frontenac is here to talk about that a little bit, giving us the bigger picture of kind of the different kinds of firms in this business, and also maybe the role of the limited partners, which we haven't talked too much about. Walter's a managing director at Frontenac, which is a Chicago-based investment firm, primarily working with the mid-size, closely held businesses.
Yeah, thanks. We're real pleased to be here. So thank you all for inviting us. And it's a great forum and I think a great topic for our country and for policy and for business right now. I'm just going to pick up on one thing Brad mentioned because I think he and his team deserve a tremendous amount of credit. We made acquisitions at SI International of roughly, I'd say, about $250 million in revenue. They organically grew the business from about $250 million in acquired revenue to over $600 million. And that led directly to job growth. And if you look at which we've done, that where our return to our investors came from, it was directly attributable not to the buying and the transactions, but directly attributable to the revenue growth, the organic revenue growth and the organic EBITDA growth and the job creation. And so fundamentally, you know, I think that's as great a success story as, you know, as is out there. And it's important to understand where the source of those returns came from. Just to step back, the way I look at it, as Ronnie mentioned, I'm a partner with a Chicago-based private equity firm. I think we're here to have proof that private equity is an industry outside of New York. It's not just in New York. There's a big part of the country, particularly in the Midwest, that's focused on middle market companies and middle market financings. There's a lot of people in the private equity industry today, just like in any industry, and there's some similarities, and I think there's some important differences. The way I look at it is there's really a continuum of investors, both on the private and on the public side. Bron mentioned a little earlier on the public side, there's debt investors, investment grade, you know, high yield, and a variety of different strategies. And on the equity side, there's a variety of different strategies. There's value investors, there's growth investors, there's technology investors, there's event-driven or distressed investors. The same is true, really, on the private equity side. There's private debt, and there's a variety of different forms of that private debt. And same is true on the private equity side. Not all private equity is the same. There are startup investors, There are venture investors, there's growth investors, and there's buyout investors, and there's a whole bunch of others. But to keep it simple, that's the way that I would describe it. Real simply, for all of those investors, we are in the business of managing money on behalf of others and ourselves. And our proposition is for every dollar, again, simply stated, for every dollar that we're entrusted, we're looking to return $2 back to our investors over a reasonable time period. And that's ranged, you know, depending on what your success is. But I think it's important not to lose sight of, you know, of what some of the similarities are. So where do we fit as a firm, and what are some of the differences? Our firm really is focused on a couple of areas and a couple of key points of difference. You know, one is our commitment to the middle market. There are a couple of definitions described here this morning. We work with companies that are roughly $25 to $200 million in revenue. And generally speaking, our goal with those investments is to double or maybe triple those investments in revenue and EBITDA during our life cycle. And if we're successful driving real growth in revenue and real growth in earnings and creating jobs along the way, then we're going to make money for our investors. It's really that simple. We're less in the what I'd call the financial engineering side of the industry, and I'll mention a little bit more about that in a second. Second, we are committed to, as Ronnie mentioned, to the private founder or family-owned company market. We are generally, if not always, the first institutional owner. Our firm's been around for roughly 40 years now. We've been involved in over 220 different types of transactions that fit that model. And in those settings, we're solving for really three objectives, which I think relate back to the discussion a little earlier this morning. First is those business owners have created a lot of wealth for themselves, built companies from nothing in many cases to whatever size they've achieved, and they're looking for personal liquidity and diversification. They've put everything on the line, and that business has gotten to a point where they're looking for financial diversification for themselves and for their family, in a lot of cases for perpetuation and continuity for their business employees. We help facilitate that liquidity in that process. Second is a lot of those businesses are looking to grow to the next level, and they need, you know, really two things. One is help thinking about how to professionalize that management team and a board of directors. And second, to start thinking about succession plans. It's rare to find an owner or an entrepreneur that's built a business that has actually thought about what the business could go on and do without him or her. They've been such a strong driving force. And we work with professional managers and families to help over time accomplish some of those objectives. And third is really to help provide capital to fund what is a latent growth plan. What we've seen time and time again is that these businesses, if I started a business and got it to $100 million and that's 100% of my family's net worth, natural instinct is I'm going to get cautious with that business. I'm going to not invest in what it's going to take to get that business to the next level because I have so much on the line. I probably have personal collateral and a personal pledge to the bank, as was mentioned this morning. Our job is to provide the capital that provides liquidity to them that allows the business to make the necessary investments to get to that next stage of growth. And oftentimes that is working with banks to relieve those founder owners from those personal guarantees. And they don't require guarantees from us because we're putting real dollars of equity underneath their securities. And so we are facilitating that next level of growth. And then two other things real briefly. One is we represent what I call patient capital. Not everybody in the private equity industry is. A lot of people are looking for short returns. We've built a patient capital model that we think is aligned well with our strategy, which is more of a 5 to 10 year time horizon. It's averaged, I think, around 7 or 8 years. Brad made an important point. You know, SI International and its success, it took 10 years, you know, to build that business as successfully as they built it from really startup to $500-600 million in revenue. We were investors in that business for 8 years. For those that know our industry, that's a very patient, long-term approach. But we believe real growth in revenue, real growth in earnings, if that's your source of value, it takes time. And I'd say the last point that's relevant for us, and I think it adds some color to the overall industry characterization, is we have built our business around a CEO-first strategy, and Brad and his team really embody that. That's really a philosophy about investing that's not based on financial engineering, but it's based on real growth in revenue and earnings, which starts with great execution and great operations. And our philosophy is that has always started and been led by great leaders of businesses. And so we believe that that is the role that we play in the capital markets, and that is the process that we believe has generated successful returns for our investors, both at Salient, SI, and many other companies over the years.
Great, fantastic. So now we've set the stage a little bit in terms of what growth capital is, who the various players are, how it affects real companies. There's been some interesting policy changes that are impacting this space that I want to turn to Chuck Morton to speak about, specifically the Jobs Act, Jumpstarting Our Business Startups Act that President Obama signed with bipartisan support. Chuck is the co-chair of the corporate practice group at Venable, LLP. His national practice solves complex problems faced by lenders, investors, and entrepreneurs as they create, build, buy, and sell companies. So, Chuck, great to have you here, and maybe you can talk a little bit about the Jobs Act and other policies that may be impacting the space.
Terrific. Thank you very much. And I should point out that in addition to my day job at Venable, I have the pleasure of serving as the chairman of the board of the Association for Corporate Growth. ACG has nearly 15,000 members in 58 chapters around the world, principally here in the U.S. Our mission is to drive middle market growth, and the stories that you're hearing today really embody what the mission of ACG is all about. So I'm joined by our CEO and other leaders of ACG. So it really is our pleasure to be here. It's our pleasure to partner with PCRI in this important work. It really does reflect, I think, what's best in what we do at ACG. So it's very nice to be here. Thank you for having us. Before I talk about the Jobs Act, I do want to briefly come back to something that Bron mentioned and highlight some points that are being made. The first, in the context of private equity, is that private equity creates jobs. It's the simple truth of it. There's been a lot of discussion about this in this election cycle. We've thought it's been an opportunity to really talk in a thoughtful way about the role of private equity. The data that Bron shared with us before was a data from a 15-year period of time, from 1994 to 2009, and that data suggests that private capital-backed businesses have grown jobs at nearly seven times the rate of non-private capital-backed companies. Now, it makes perfect sense, and not just sort of from a data perspective, when you hear the story that we provided anecdotally here today. Private capital is likely to be invested at companies at a point of inflection, and they're able to bring that money to bear as well as human capital to help enhance the returns and the performance of those businesses. So the data reflects not just job growth, but also growth in sales, and that's over an extended period of time, not just a single, you know, one-year snapshot in time. We're working hard to update that data, and it is an exciting part of the story that we're eager to tell. The second part of the story is that private capital creates returns for limited partners who are everywhere. And to be clear, this was hinted out a minute ago, ultimately private capital investors, just like all the rest of us, are working for other people. They're investors, and their goal is to try to create returns for those investors. And the sort of complexion of those investors, in today's economy at least, really are made up by public pension funds. It's made up by university endowments. For example, I have the pleasure of serving as a trustee of a university-affiliated endowment. We've deployed part of our investment dollars into these alternative investment vehicles in the hopes of ultimately subsidizing the education that the students receive at this university. Those are the principal investors in private equity. So when you create these returns, this isn't just something that's sort of dropping into the lap of people in Wall Street. This is money that's creating and making a difference for those limited investors. And they are everywhere. So a picture of private equity that fails to recognize where those returns are going to is an incomplete picture. And then the final point is that private capital-backed companies are everywhere. So not just the investors, but the companies themselves are everywhere. So there's lots of examples of this. The website that Bron mentioned before, growtheconomy.org, has this wonderful map of the country overall. And you can zoom in your local area to see where private capital-backed companies are. That's growtheconomy.org. I think the rule of thumb is if you say it three times, people remember it. So that's the third and final time, I promise. But if you go to that website, you'll be able to get a map that shows clearly where these private capital-backed companies may be located. And I will tell you, I was frankly stunned when I saw the map. I, too, had the perception that private capital-backed companies were likely to simply be in Silicon Valley, or maybe here around the Beltway, or maybe in Boston or San Diego in the bio industry. But in fact, those companies are everywhere, and they are relatively ordinary companies. So I encourage you to check out that data. I think it's compelling, and I think that if we're going to have a thoughtful discussion about the role of private capital in the United States, it's important to try to depoliticize it, focus on the facts, and understand how all this stuff plays out so that we can have a thoughtful framing of public policy. So those are sort of the three starting points. There's an old Chinese proverb, may you live in interesting times. And for securities lawyers, these are very, very interesting times. Since the 1930s, there had been a carefully orchestrated framework of investment rules, fundamentally designed around forcing disclosures, having registration, with a carefully crafted collection of carve-outs from public reporting requirements. And that was a framework that largely had remained intact for more than 70 years. Fast forward to Enron and other scandals that were the prelude to Sarbanes-Oxley, and you had an awareness of the fact that maybe that collection of rules wasn't working so well. Maybe it wasn't protecting ordinary investors. Maybe it wasn't extracting the sort of honesty and integrity that we expect to be reflected in the public markets. And that gave birth to Sarbanes-Oxley, a series of regulations, obviously well-intended, designed, particularly when you combine them with some other regulations, to have more robust disclosures across a broader spectrum of asset classes, all designed to protect investors. Then we had that, in a broad context, collide with the Great Recession. And there was a realization that we need to continue to be a place where capital can be efficiently and effectively deployed, and that we were potentially losing our competitive edge. People were filing to go public in places like London or, heaven forbid, Hong Kong, and our public markets were shriveling. They simply did not enjoy the level of activity that we had grown accustomed to. And there was a recognition that we needed, notwithstanding the Great Recession and all of the challenges that were faced at that time, to try to make our markets more attractive, a better place, a more efficient place to raise capital. But it was interesting because these were sort of colliding public trends. You had the disclosure trends, Sarbanes-Oxley and Dodd-Frank, colliding with the recognition that we were becoming an exceptionally expensive place to raise capital. Now, frankly, in that mix is one of the reasons why private equity was so successful and so meaningful. Because if you're a business with less than $1 billion in revenue, or heaven forbid, less than $100 million in revenue, you needed to have a way to get your business at that inflection point capital. And private equity served an incredibly and continues to serve an incredibly important way to provide that capital. But the Jobs Act was also designed to help fill that void and make it easier for capital to be accessed. So the Jobs Act, as many of you probably know, was approved last spring. We continue to be in the midst of the rulemaking regime for almost every aspect of the Jobs Act. It has proven more difficult than folks might have anticipated, at least folks who are unfamiliar with what 75 years of inertia has created in our securities laws. But there are three important aspects of it that I think could possibly make an enormous difference here. The first of which I'll talk about, we're going to hear a whole panel presentation on later, and that's crowdfunding. So one of the other enduring trends that have happened over the past is access to information and the ability for people to get information in an incredibly democratizing way through the web. So that has made possible things like Kiva, which is a peer-to-peer lending site, and other forms of capital formation where regular folks can access folks who need capital, often very modest amounts of capital, very inexpensively, out there in the cloud, as they would say. And crowdfunding and the framework provided by the Jobs Act to get to crowdfunding reflects some of those trends. And sort of the big picture, the crowdfunding provisions of the Jobs Act provide for individuals or companies to raise under $1 million a year through registered portals or broker-dealers if the amounts purchased are modest amounts. And that depends based upon your net worth and income. Generally speaking, it's either $2,000 or 10% of your net worth as an investment. So again, it's the general framework of access to information on the web. There are restrictions about the type of information that must be provided, but it's far less onerous, far less detailed than would be required typically in a public offering. And it protects the investors, protecting quotation marks, by limiting the amount of money that they may invest relative to their economic position. So that's crowdfunding. Secondly, I want to talk about the changes to Rule 506. Rule 506 fundamentally has historically limited the amount of advertising that individuals could provide to non-accredited investors. So again, the general framework is only accredited investors can make investments in companies that are not public. And so the notion is that you want to limit the amount of advertising to those folks. That creates a conundrum, though, because you don't know who's necessarily an accredited investor when you're trying to raise money. So the net effect of that has been to create a very focused offering on a narrow group of friends and family or carefully screened pre-registered accredited investors, which has had a chilling effect on the amount of capital or the way in which capital could be raised. So one of the changes in the Jobs Act is to make it far easier to have a general solicitation, but still ensure that the ultimate investors are accredited investors. Now, there was a rulemaking published by the SEC in the middle of August. It seemed like we were going to move relatively quickly towards a set of rules that would help us to navigate that. The response to the SEC's proposal was more than 150 responses, which has caused the SEC, I think, to pull back a little bit and to try to more carefully navigate the circumstances under which you can have this general solicitation. So that is, right now, I think it's fair to characterize as been mired a little bit in the rulemaking process. And then the third thing that I'll only briefly mention because of the time pressures is there has been efforts made to try to create a class of companies that can go public, generally companies with less than $1 billion in revenues, that have an on-ramp to the public markets that would be less onerous, where there are less reporting requirements, both pre-IPO and post-IPO, and a general effort to make that process less costly and less onerous on the folks attempting to raise capital. So what you have is this regulatory effort to try to lessen the burden to get access to public markets, while at the same time the role of private equity continues to be very important.
Great. Okay, so I think now we have some time for Q&A till 11:15 or so on schedule. So maybe we can start with a few questions, and if there's a lapse, I can always jump in. So, yeah, go ahead.
Thank you. I think if I could do one thing on my Christmas list, I wish I could give capital a conscience. We wouldn't have to deal with Sarbanes-Oxley and Dodd-Frank. But that being said, I would, since it's been brought up, I would like to know what is the profile of a good private equity firm to do business with versus a bad private equity firm to do business with.
So, and the other thing I think we can deal with as we go in this is, you know, I think the heart of this question is about incentives being aligned at all the different parts. So from the limited partners like the pension funds and the universities who are investing, the general partners who are managing the fund, the CEOs of the company, and the workers in the community. So thinking about sort of are the incentives aligned at all parts of that chain and how that actually works. And Walter, maybe you talked about that most deeply, so maybe you can start us off.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not entirely sure how to answer that question other than the way we look at it, right, which is I think our business is – has nothing to do with capital at some level. I mean, because there's a lot of capital out there. I think it has to do with integrity. And are you going to do what you say you're going to do? You know, Brad and his team put a lot of trust in us when we form a partnership. There's a document that you have to lean back and rely on if something goes, you know, bump. But, you know, you get in business, whether it's, you know, you get in business with your neighbor to open up a restaurant or you get in business with a private equity firm to go buy a company and build, or whether it's somebody in this audience entrusting us with their capital, are we going to do and say what we're going to do? And so I always encourage people, we've been in business for 40 years. We've made mistakes. I think if you're in the investment business, You have to, and I think you learn from those. But it's a question of how do you behave, you know, in when are you a steady hand when good things happen and when bad things happen, and are you going to be there to sort of work through those? So anybody that's considering working with private equity, my best advice is to, you know, do diligence on them, get references, understanding, you know, who those people are and how you're going to deal with it. And nothing's guaranteed in life, but, you know, if you have a good set of relationships and, you know, people that are, you know, that represent integrity, I think on both sides of the table, usually, you know, the right decisions get made. That's how I look at that answer. And that's not to say there are people in our business that don't have that. I think everybody believes in relationships and integrity. But the best proof is the proof of, you know, of history and how they've behaved. And so that's why I say, you know, check them out.
I would just add to that I think it's important that it's like getting married. I mean, it really is a long-term relationship. It's important that you both have the same expectations going into it and coming out. And frankly, private equity isn't any good if it's not there when you need it. So it's important to have a clear understanding of how you're going to execute, how you're going to use that that equity, and make sure that it's going to be there when you need it. Otherwise, it's an empty relationship.
I think there's another side to this equation, and there are other people, you know, that could address this, you know, later. But it's those that entrust us with their capital, the limited partner community, and I think they look for a lot of things. You know, others are in a better position to describe this, but I think they look for successful investment track record, because fundamentally they're investing for a return. But I think at some level they're looking to make a decision: are you going to be a good fiduciary of their capital, how are you going to use it?
And let me address that question from the perspective of a limited. So not my ACG hat, not my Venable hat, but my role as a trustee of a university-related endowment. So from that perspective, our time horizon is forever. So we have this pool of capital that we're entrusted with, largely by people who have entrusted it to this particular endowment who are long since gone. And I feel a tremendous responsibility for trying to be a wise steward for those funds. Now, that involves a lot of tension. So there's preservation of capital. So we allocate some of that in very, very conservative investments. But there is an aspect of ensuring or working hard to try to ensure that that money grows. The difference over the time I've already been a trustee for 7 or 8 years, I'm likely to be a trustee of these particular funds for a long time going forward. My firm has been a trustee of these funds for more than 100 years. So when various partners of the firm have had the pleasure of serving in this role, all pro bono. So when I think about the time horizon, and our investment advisors model out for me the difference between a 7% return and a 9% return, and what we can do by way of scholarship support in supporting the research of this university, that 2 percentage points is enormous. I mean, it changes radically the lives of lots of young people. So we try to fashion an asset allocation model that reflects a proper balance of risk and reward, what are described as alternative classifications, of which private equity, for example, would be a part. Can help to create those returns. Now, if you get too overly weighted, when things are down, you get crushed. You know, it's good on the upside, it's bitter on the downside. So you try to balance that out all in a way that makes sense. But so when we're picking those in whom we intend to deploy a small part of that investment pie through alternatives in the world of private equity, just a couple percent of the portfolio overall, I first and foremost want returns. Because that's going to help to create the opportunity for folks who I feel, you know, we can talk about it as a fiduciary obligation. You can talk about all these from a legal perspective. At the bottom line is I feel a responsibility to try to help these students and the people who benefit from the research. So it's about returns, and I'm not bashful about it. Now, I think that socially responsible businesses over the long run, frankly, do better with returns. I think there's lots of data to support that. So that sort of fits into the mix. But I'm looking for returns. So,
right. So yeah. In the back? Oh, you want to follow up, Martin?
Can I just comment on that?
Professor.
Just to be the devil's advocate, I had this conversation with people the other day about returns, and they say, look, There is a set of economists who argue that pension funds and maybe endowments should only invest in safe assets. And you're going to earn 2%. And those safe assets are only earning 2%. And so the, the 9% or the 7% that you're getting has to involve a great deal of risk. And can you comment on that side of the, that equation, whether it's appropriate for a pension fund or a university to be taking that level of risk?
Sure. Now, again, I don't want to overstate my role, but I do acknowledge that it's my day job. I'm a lawyer. But my view of this and what we're encouraged by our investment advisors to think about is a proper allocation to try to frame that risk in a way that becomes rational. There is obviously also risk, inflationary risk, among other risks, of not of just parking your money in something that is very, very safe at 2%. And in education, obviously, inflationary risks have been enormous. If you're simply getting a 2% return on an endowment and yet the cost of education are outstripping inflation and are 8%, whatever they've been over the past 15 years, the real purchasing power of that money is being corroded every year. So for me, at least, wearing my hat as a trustee, it's about a proper allocation to properly frame that risk and a recognition that there are other risks, for example, inflationary risk, that can really hurt you if your returns are too modest.
The best advice I've gotten is, you know, just like you would get for personal financial advice, is what are your goals and objectives? What's your the people you represent, whether it's a pension fund or a foundation or an endowment or a family, what are their risk profiles? What are their risk tolerances and how can they live within the band there? And then what you want to try to do within that is select managers that, you know, that fit that profile. So I would agree with you. I think it's about risk-adjusted returns and trying to solve for an objective as opposed to just chasing, you know, the sort of highest dollar return that's out there.
Sure. Just so two things. You were asking about alignment of interest before, and I think it's important in the private equity industry, in which I also work, to understand the way people get paid. So in mid-market firms like Frontenac and like Riverside, where I work, we don't take very much money from our management fees because our funds are small. So the only way we get paid is really from the carry, about which there's been certainly lots of controversy. But important to understand that we don't get it unless and until we deliver an 8% return to our investors. So our incentives are completely aligned with our investors because it's not until the end of the process when we've made a successful investment and we've returned to all those policemen and firemen, pension funds who have invested with us that money. So that's one. And then I think the second thing to the question that was just asked is, you know, it's a very competitive world out there. So if you as a private equity firm don't consistently deliver return to your pension fund investors, you aren't raising your next fund. That's it. It's a survival of the fittest game. Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm.
Right here, sure.
Yes, thank you. If we take the current climate as it exists today, from a private equity perspective, is it attractive to engage in what state and local governments are doing, and also the federal government, in these private public partnerships where risk is transferred to the private partner in order, let's say, to develop, construct a building or a facility, and then they assume all the financing risk and then possibly even the, certainly the construction risk, but then also possibly the operating risk. Does that seem to be an attractive option today, or do you think private equity firms might look at that and say, nah, it's another government program we don't want to really get into?
I guess I'll take a shot at that. That's not our business, first of all, so let me start with that, but I am somewhat familiar with it. And let me describe it the way I understand it. But there are infrastructure funds, and there are folks that are privatizing, you know, sort of public operations, whether it's the toll roads in Chicago or whether it's, you know, water treatment facilities or what have you. I think it's just a maturing of the capital markets. And so what they are doing is they're slicing another portion of an asset class, just as you have bonds that are, single B, double B, triple B. You have, equity that's, focused on different segments. I think these infrastructure, public-private, partnerships represent a privatization of the public finance markets, if you would. And so I think for certain investors, I know insurance companies are active, in those markets. They were looking at privatizing Midway Airport a number of years ago. They privatized, the parking and meter business in the city of Chicago. I think there is a financial return, to be had there. I think it comes back to the discussion you had before is what is the risk profile that those limited partners are looking for, and does that investment proposition that's represented by these public-private investors match up with what the expectations are and how they're getting financed? I wonder, is it in the long-term best interest personally of the cities, or is it a short-term funding, solution? But that's a whole different policy topic for, that frankly I'm not, well enough versed other than to have just casual opinion on.
Other comments on this? I mean, this has come up big with the infrastructure bank that's being considered now, which you might be referring to. So, I mean, having personally worked on these kind of issues, I think that there's clearly a tremendous need to rebuild American infrastructure. So that's why people are looking for these sources. The terms of the contracts, things like springing liens, when they come into effect and how they're designed, will have a big impact on how attractive it is, both to the government side and the business side.
So in general, I mean, I believe the capital markets are relatively efficient, right? And so there will be a segment of investors that product appeals to. How big that is, whether it's ultimately successful, I don't know, but there will be a segment of the capital markets that product will appeal to, and hopefully it leads to, positive outcomes and productivity for us as citizens.
Mm-hmm. Do we have time for one more question? Okay, great. Yeah, sure, right here.
Yes, I was sort of interested differentiating your business from the venture capital. The venture capital businesses are notoriously about home runs. 70% of their firms don't pay nothing, 20% do some return, and 10% go out of the ball, hit them out home runs. What's your profile of belly ups? How do you all make money? Who goes up? What's your upside? What's your downside, et cetera?
Maybe you can also touch to the woman's point in the back about a lot of venture capital firms moving into growth capital and the fee structure and how that works.
Sure, I'll try to fit all that in. Mm-hmm. I think we're short on time. But, real briefly, you're exactly right. I, my layman's description, the venture business is sprinkle and sprout. You have, two home runs, get your money back in, a small return and, four of those investments and lose your capital in the others. And that's probably over a 40 or 50 company portfolio, just to make it up. And I'm truly making those numbers up. But directionally, I think that's the model. Our business, and so there's a lot of volatility there. And I think investors are, there are firms that are experts at that business, and they've proven time and time again that they can generate those home run returns. And if you look at the attribution of those returns, those funds make money off of, a handful of deals. Our business is very different. We're going to have 8 to 12 companies in a fund. I say we're in the singles and doubles business. For our firm, the last two funds, the last 23 deals, we've lost our capital in two. It's represented 6% of our capital. We've made 1.5 to 5 times our money in the rest of those deals, and we'll deliver, 2.3 or 2.4 times our money in those businesses. It's with less leverage in our portfolio than is typical. It's a lower beta, lower return, strategy. Our investors are looking for a mix of certainty of capital and preservation of returns and lower loss volatility as a result of that. That makes it challenging, I'll be honest, for us to deliver, top quartile returns because we're not swinging for the fences. It doesn't mean we can't do it, and we have in the past, but it means you got to get there slightly differently. And I think that reflects a maturing of our asset class. our limited partners and the limited partners in this community, they want to make their own asset allocation decisions of how much risk they want and who's good at that risk and how much lower volatility but stable returns that they want. And so there are different strategies, I think, and different returns approaches. The other point I'd make is not all firms, you know, if you deliver the same 2.3 times your money, you know, over a reasonable period of time, they may have underlying taken very different risks in order to get there. Some may have relied entirely on leverage, and as we've seen, leverage can work both ways. It can help you, it can hurt you. And so is that a repeatable model as it relates to what your source of returns are? So I think smart limited partners are looking today at what's the underlying source of those returns. How does that match up with what their objectives are, and is that repeatable, you know, over time? And I may have forgot the
It also has to do with the stage of the company as well. I mean, venture capital, you know, I mentioned seed capital. That's usually, you know, $1 million or less in revenue, pre-revenue even. Venture capitalists nowadays tend to kick in about at $1 million of revenue. They start to look at companies, and maybe you go up to $10 million or so. So the private equity guys are much later stage. They probably have cash flow. They can take on debt. It's a different stage of business as well, and that also tends to correlate with the risks somewhat.
So with that, I think we should conclude the panel. We're glad to continue the conversation offline. I want to thank the audience for a great discussion, also our four panelists for today. Thank you. We'll be back here at 11:30 for our next presentation, so we take a short break.